Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the PAION AG conference call hosted by Dr. Wolfgang Söhngen. My name is Steffi, and I will be your coordinator for today's conference. For the duration of the call, you will be on listen only. However, at the end of the call, you will have the opportunity to ask questions. If at any time you need assistance, please press star zero on your telephone keypad, and you will be connected to an operator. I am now handing you over to Mr. Ralf Penner to begin today's conference. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much for your kind introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us for PAION's conference call about the project status of remimazolam in Japan. My name is Ralf Penner. I'm PAION's Director of Investor Relations, and I'll be moderating today's call. I'm joined by Wolfgang Söhngen, PAION's CEO, Mariola Söhngen, our CMO, as well as Abdelghany Omari, our CFO. Within the next 15 minutes, we give further explanations to the press and ad hoc release published on October 10, 2014. After this initial presentation, we are happy to take your questions. I would like to point out that the slides for the presentation can be accessed by webcast in parallel to this conference call. The webcast details were given in today's press release. If you have not already opened the webcast link, you may want to do so now. This conference call is being recorded and a replay will be available later today. Before we get started, I would like to remind you that today's call may include forward-looking statements and that the actual results may vary from PAION's current anticipation. I would also like to refer to the disclaimer included in the presentation slides. After these initial remarks, I believe that we should start right on now. Wolfgang, please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Ralf, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I welcome you from the ASA 2014 in New Orleans, Louisiana, in the United States. After our conversation with our partner owner in Japan, we directly moved over here because this is a very important anesthesia meeting, and we are also have presented the phase 2 data in general anesthesia in cardiac surgery patients, which was very well received. The meeting with owner triggered the ad hoc release published last Friday, which will be the subject of this conference call today. As you know, we develop our main product, remimazolam, in three indications: procedural sedation, general anesthesia, and ICU sedation. And as we have expected, that we have a lot of not medics or specialists in the field, we have tried to somehow describe the different levels of sedation and the different lengths of sedation in the slide with the dolphins. So the major message is that for the different indications, you require different depths of sedation. So the small dip of the dolphin that's in the middle should symbol what's happening in procedural sedation. You get a low dose of remimazolam, you go under, and after a couple of minutes, you wake up and you can walk away. The second one is general anesthesia, where the patient really gets down very deep so that he does not remember the operation and that there is no awakening during the operation. That requires the highest dose. And then, lastly, we have ICU sedation, that is symbolized by the dolphin that swims beyond, you know, into the next day. And this requires a somewhat intermediate dosing because it also needs and requires an intermediate sedation between procedural sedation and general anesthesia. So this is just to somehow explain to the lay persons on the call why these different indications require different dosing, like the dolphin needs to have different techniques to get to these different levels in the ocean. On the next slide, We have to ask the question, and that was obviously some concern, does remimazolam have a problem? And our answer to this is higher than expected remimazolam plasma levels are rather a phenomenon than a problem, because plasma levels which are higher than normal in stable patients or volunteers, and these are usually the basis for modeling, are a phenomenon that is observed for drugs used in the ICU in general. It has to be considered a problem, however, if it leads to serious side effects. This was not the case in the study at discussion. It also has to be excluded whether this could be or is a result of overdosing. This has not been tested because the study was not continued, but it is our present assumption. It is also assumed in the whole discussion, but it's also not proven beyond doubt, that the sampling or processing errors in measurement were a cause for the high plasma levels. Why do patients frequently or not seldom have higher than normal plasma levels when they're on the ICU? It is a known but not fully understood phenomenon. The explanation is that patients often have multiple problems, which is the reason why they're on the ICU, otherwise they could be on the normal ward. One of the major problems is that some of them have suffered from severe blood loss or fluid loss, or they have a fluid overload in order to compensate these effects. The second, probably most important point is that frequently these patients have subcritical perfusion of organs like the kidney or the liver, which is due to low blood pressure, and or the application of drugs that lead to vasoconstriction in order to counteract the low blood pressure. And then also you have to consider that multiple drugs which are applied in this situation also are targeting different problems of the patients, and they may have an influence. And finally, one has to exclude a relative overdose of the drug in question given the above factors. So plasma levels itself do not give the answer whether this is a problem. On the next slide, I have summarized again, more for those who are not familiar with anesthesia, that what is current practice and what is required in anesthesia is actually a combination of drugs that have different tasks. Remimazolam and propofol and midazolam as well, they are there to put the patient to sleep. On the left lower corner, analgesia drugs like fentanyl, sufentanyl, remifentanyl are used to take out the pain of the intervention. And it is quite clear, because of the same metabolism and the same fast on and offset, that remimazolam and remifentanyl would be the ideal combination in such a situation, both in general anesthesia and in ICU sedation. Muscle relaxation is not an issue for ICU sedation. So I hope that explains some of the effects that we're seeing, because you also have to differentiate, do the side effects or the deep sedation come from analgesia drugs, or do they come from the anesthetic or hypnotic? So there's a known fact that remimazolam and other sedatives and anesthetics have to be adjusted in their dose if they're combined with opioids. We have seen it in our own trials, and we knew that and we accommodated that the starting dose for colonoscopy is 5 milligram, whereas the starting dose for upper GI endoscopy is 10 milligram. In the case of colonoscopy, fentanyl is given in addition to subdue the pain that the patient may experience, whereas in upper GI, no opioid is given because it's not a painful intervention. But you see that the dose for remimazolam is twice as high as in the first case. So in general, one can say that a dose reduction of approximately 50% is known for combinations of benzodiazepines with opioids or with other sedatives, anesthetics. Again, I try to use in the next slide a picture to illustrate to the layperson what this means. So if you combine remimazolam with fentanyl, you actually have drugs that have different ways to operate. Remimazolam, as we know, is quick on and quick off, and fentanyl is slow. So the slow elimination of fentanyl has a dramatic effect on the wake-up times that are possible for these patients. So we recommend to combine remimazolam and remifentanyl both for general anesthesia and for ICU sedation. Unfortunately, in Japan, remifentanyl is not approved for the use in ICU sedation. So fentanyl was used in the study, and it is sometimes difficult to evaluate where longer wake-up times come from, whether from the opioid or from the sedative. Now let me explain a little bit on the plasma levels, what we have seen so far in our ongoing program, and where this is in relation to the elevated plasma levels that were reported in the ICU sedation study. The next slide shows you the result that we generated in the first in man study, and what you see is in the blue curve a high plasma level. This is when the drug is given rapidly over 1 minute, and this high dose is needed to bring the patient down. And then you see that this curve rapidly goes down, but in the green circle you see this is the area and the time where the patient will be sedated enough to, for example, undergo a colonoscopy or an upper GI. And then the drug is eliminated. And you also see that the non-active metabolite, which is called CNS-7054, is going up while remimazolam is going down. So that's the situation for fetal sedation. If you now look at the plasma levels that we have measured in cardiac surgery patients, you see that with the induction dose, we bring up the plasma levels to 12,000 nanogram per milliliter, which is significantly higher than what is, you know, present in procedural sedation. And then once the patient is intubated and the surgery has started, it is reduced to a maintenance dose. And then when the operation is finished, where it says reduction to PACU dose, then the patient is, the dose is further reduced to about 1/10 of the maintenance dose. And this is a dose that is still high enough to keep the patient sedated enough to ventilate the patient. And finally, when the patient is planned to be extubated, this dose is shut off, and you see that the plasma levels of remimazolam go down as planned, and that with a little bit of a delay, the metabolite levels also decrease. Now, if you put this in perspective on the next slide to the plasma levels that were measured in the ICU sedation, you see that in this red circle, this is covering more or less all the samples that were measured in this ICU sedation study, are significant to a certain degree significantly higher than the plasma levels that were measured during cardiac surgery patients, where you usually dose to a much higher degree. And this is related to the fact that a dose was used that probably didn't lead to a steady state. A steady state means that you infuse so much dose that the plasma level is kept at a defined level. And this is something that obviously didn't happen. Now, what is the conclusion that we have drawn from this? It is displayed on the second, on the next slide. And you see that with a reduced dose, which would be in this green circle, and which is also lower than the maintenance dose. And the maintenance plasma levels of remimazolam that we have measured during general surgery, this is the target dose that we anticipate for ICU sedation. Coming back to the slide with the dolphins, I hope I could explain even to laypersons that it seems logical that dosing in ICU sedation and plasma levels in ICU sedation should be somewhere between that of general anesthesia and procedural sedation. And this is what we are aiming for. On the next slide is a beautiful slide of the last and final experiment that we have performed together with our partner Ono. What you see here is that the red curve represents the remimazolam plasma concentration, which initially, like, you know, usually is just set up the system, is high, and then after a certain time it stabilizes at a certain level. And this experiment went on for 5 days. You see, so that for 120 hours, this is a 5-day continuous superfusion of isolated hepatic cells. Nothing is happening. The levels that are measured remain the same over these 5 days. And also the plasma level of the metabolite, which is the CNS 7056, the green curve, goes up as expected, and then it levels out to a certain level. This is what we would expect also to see in ICU sedation with adequate dosing. And this also proves one of the critical hypotheses that why we did these preclinical experiments, because if this high unexpected plasma levels would indicate that there is a situation where the enzymes, so to say, get tired and they no longer process remimazolam as they should do, then this will lead to higher than expected plasma levels. But we have not seen this in any of the experiments. On the other hand, the other hypothesis would be that the metabolites that are produced somehow inhibit the activity of the enzymes. But also this could not be found in this experiment. So we think we have really a clean bill of health for remimazolam, given all the experiments and results that are on the table. Now, what are our conclusions? The first ICU sedation trial showed good efficacy and safety, which is the main point about which we were very enthusiastic at the time. Although I understand disappointment of people when the study is stopped or when it doesn't deliver the results that you expect, this study has an extremely high value for the further development in this indication, because we now understand what is a potential ceiling dose. Ceiling dose means the highest use dose that you should be able to, or that you should use or could use without endangering the patient. So we are of the opinion, based on our modeling, that the dose were probably 5 to 10 times higher than needed or that we would apply, and also that patients not necessarily all were titrated to effect. That means patients, both in general anesthesia and in ICU sedation, have sometimes a fluctuating state of sedation, and therefore the dose must be adjusted to the clinical situation of the patients. There are two ways to do this. One way is you can measure this with an EEG, but you also can do this clinically. And from what I understand, the patients in the first ICU sedation study were very much close to general anesthesia sedation. Furthermore, the use of fentanyl should not be implemented in the use of a short-acting drug in the continuous infusion, because the fentanyl half-life goes up to several hours when it is given at high doses. And finally, a short-acting opioid should be used in ICU sedation to facilitate rapid wake-up. Secondly, so far we don't have any logical or scientific explanation why there were elevated plasma levels in 6 out of 49 patients. But we could rule out that there is a reduction in enzyme activity present. We did not see any self-inhibition through metabolites, and this has been confirmed by independent experimental setups. The fact that the first dose-finding study does not always lead to the identification of the optimal dose is a frequent theme in development. You may recall that even in our procedural sedation, where everyone feels we have identified a very good dose to go forward, it took us 3 studies to identify the right dose. It is a learning exercise. Hmm. We have to titrate between too high dose and too low dose, and that sometimes takes several studies. Our conclusion is that doses in ICU going forward need to be significantly lower, and because we have not seen a real safety issue, we also expect that there is no spillover effect to the general anesthesia or procedural sedation programs. The data of the ICU sedation trial have been part of the dossiers that were submitted to both the FDA and EMEA, and there was no concern raised in our discussions when it came to general anesthesia and or procedural sedation. I would now like to thank you for listening in, and because we have a limited time, I would like to conclude my presentation for now and open the floor for questions. Thank you very much for your attendance.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you change your mind and wish to withdraw your question, please press star 1 again. You will be advised when to ask your question. And our first question comes from the line of Dr. James Jackson from Close Brothers. Please go ahead.
Hello, Wolfgang. Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you well.
Thank you for your presentation. I have one question which maybe has 2 parts. Mm-hmm. I would conclude from your presentation, which, you know, I'm sure is quite difficult for some of the non-specialists, that in the ideal world, those phase 2 ICU trials would have been conducted in a slightly different fashion. My question is really, have you had this discussion with ONO, and do they understand the points that you raise?
Thank you for the question. Yes, we have addressed this point with ONO, but I would describe it as a cultural difference in how these things are looked at. I would say in the Western world, the opinion of the physicians that I discussed this with, and here at the anesthesia meeting, we also have had intensive discussions with international anesthesiologists. They say an elevated plasma level without a clinical sign is not really relevant. It happens all the time, specifically in patients under ICU sedation. However, we have to respect that obviously in ONO's mind, unexplainable high plasma levels can hypothetically indicate that there is a problem. We don't share that opinion, but we have to wait what the ONO decision makers, how they value the arguments that we have put on the table.
The follow-on to that is, do you have the impression that they're going to repeat this study in a current or a modified form at all?
This is completely dependent on how they value the problem. If they think it is not explainable with other methods than a clinical trial, they may not want to do that.
Okay, I understand. Thank you for your answers.
Just a reminder, please press star 1 on your keypad to ask a question. The next question comes from the line of Igor Kim from Close Brothers Seidler. Please go ahead.
Hello, everyone. I have a couple of questions. This issue with the findings in ICU sedation, could it briefly explain why ONO found it necessary to delay the submission for general anesthesia? I mean, as you mentioned, there is no spillover effect, but what is your personal opinion? What could be behind that? And the second question, if I correctly understood, this is not a relevant issue in ICU sedation, so it has already been observed with other anesthetics, let's say propofol or dexmedetomidine. Could you confirm it?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, I think it depends on whether you regard this as a phenomenon or a problem that drives your decision making. We are of the opinion that this is a phenomenon, and ONO obviously regards it more as a problem. And if they see this and continue to regard this as a problem, they may speculate that although we have not seen it so far, it could also occur in general anesthesia. That may be the way they think and they judge this. But we don't follow that argument, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the second question, did you hear it?
Sorry, can you please repeat?
The second question was, this phenomenon, was it also observed with, as far as I understood, in other types of anesthetics, like propofol or dexmedetomidine? So it shouldn't be something new, right, for ICU sedation?
No, it is, as I've said during the presentation, this is something that is observed for other drugs that are used on the ICUs, in the ICU sedation setting, not only for anesthetics, but specifically, yes, for propofol, yes, for dexmedetomidine, yes, for remifentanil. This has been observed sometimes in patients.
Okay, and just the last question, perhaps. You've been yesterday on the Congress. Could you briefly summarize what kind of topics were touched upon by the specialists, and have they addressed this phenomenon in ICU sedation? Thank you.
None of them has addressed it because they don't regard it as a problem. We have had a booth here, and we had a tremendous amount of visitors from mostly U.S., but also international anesthesiologists. And the summary of what they said is, this is what we've been waiting for. This is a drug that we want to work with. How soon will you bring this on the market? So that was very encouraging feedback.
Okay, thank you very much.
Just a final reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad now. The next question comes from the line of Jens Haselmeier from First Berlin. Please go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my question. It's the last one or on the last point of your conclusion on slide 16, and I just wanted to clarify if I understood correctly.
Yeah.
When it comes to the spillover effect on the programs PION is carrying out, so you
correct.
Said that you have been in touch with the EMA and FDA regarding a, let's say, possible threat to the programs you're doing, and that this is not given?
No, this
okay.
is not what I said I wanted to say. What I said is that the data of the ICU sedation were part of the package that we submitted with our application for the phase 3 program. So it is an integrated part of the data set of the database, and it has explained in this briefing book what happened. And the FDA and MEI have read those documents very carefully, and we had a lot of questions that we had to answer to them, just for clarification, some for giving additional information, but never this question with regards to ICU sedation came back as a question. So we assume this as a sign that it is not regarded by these agencies as any problem or threat for the two indications.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, there are no further questions, so I will hand you back to your host for any concluding remarks.
Thank you very much for all your questions and for joining us for PIONS conference call today. I hope that we have been able to answer your questions, but please feel free to give me a call afterwards. If you would like to listen to this call again, please also visit the investor section of our website, where the replay details will be posted later today. For now, I say goodbye and thank you very much for your continued interest in PION.
Thank you for joining today's conference call. You may now replace your handsets.